Party nominees for statewide office like comptroller and treasurer, as well as a host of congressional, legislative, and county government seats. Once the votes are cast, AM 580 will bring you comprehensive coverage of the count, the reactions, and the analysis from our staff in Illinois Public Radio in Springfield and Chicago. Our coverage starts tonight at 7 o'clock. Live election coverage on Illinois Public Media.
It's 2:40 in sports. Martina Hingis says she can't help but think about making yet another comeback when she sees the success Kim Clijsters and Justine Henin are having after being away from tennis. Hingis retired for the second time in 2007 when she was banned for testing positive for cocaine. That suspension ended in September, and the five-time Grand Slam singles champion will be playing more tennis this year. The 29-year-old Hingis has committed to a full season of World Team Tennis, the league founded by Billie Jean King, and heading into its 35th season, Hingis will be assigned to a team in next week's draft. However, Hingis tells the Associated Press she is ruling out the possibility of returning to the tour at this point, primarily because there's too much travel. The Chicago Bulls are back home after a successful seven-game road trip. They'll try to win their sixth game in a row tonight against the Los Angeles Clippers. The Indiana Pacers are home and hosting Toronto tonight. Northwestern hosts Michigan tonight in men's Big Ten play. The Wildcats are beginning a stretch of home games with four of their next five at Welsh Ryan Arena. And Reed Johnson is heading west. The free agent outfielder, who spent the last 2 years with the Cubs, has signed a one-year contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Injuries limited Johnson to 65 games last season. That's sports.
WILL programs are made possible by English Hedgerow, full-service florist located at University and Lincoln Avenue, Urbana. English Hedgerow can coordinate your next party with fresh flowers, innovative designs, and a different accent.
Have you ever given someone a gift only to have that person break it, mistreat it, or take it for granted? Well, the grandson of a man who gave a big chunk of land for a city park says that's exactly what's happened to his family's gift. So he's going to court to get the land back. Sarah Hewlett has this story about the dispute, which highlights a problem facing many cities.
Eliza Howell Park is an oasis from the blight, traffic, and hard knocks neighborhoods that surround it. At almost 140 acres, it's one of Detroit's biggest parks. It has woods and trails and a pair of rivers that come together at the south end, but it's also got some problems.
Those little red posts sticking, that's actually a picnic table. It's all gone. People have stolen, broken everything. All the sewer grates in the park have been stolen. They maintain nothing.
That's Ken Shane. It's his grandfather who deeded this park to the city more than 70 years ago with the requirement that it be used for park and recreation purposes. Now, he says, the city has virtually abandoned it.
There's been burned out cars in here. On the south end, there was a boat for over 2 years, just this old, awful, you know, derelict, broken boat.
The city has also barricaded the park's entrances at times. Shane says that also signals abandonment, but it's open to traffic today. As Shane drives around the park, he's got to steer around huge potholes and washed out parts of the road. People have dumped trash in the park, and the grass is waist high. Shane says all this adds up to neglect, so he's asking a judge to give the land back to the family. And Shane, who's a developer, says if that happens, he wants to build new retail stores on the land. He also says he'll keep part of it a park that the public can use, but he says he'll pay to have it maintained so it's much more attractive than it is now.
It's a land grab.
That's Larry Quarles. He's the head of a group formed to help fight Shane's effort.
So it's purely a simple, you know, if the land goes back to him, he's going to develop it, and this park is gone forever. You know, kids from now on will never have a chance to play in this park. Yeah, it's the wrong thing to do just because the city has fallen on hard times.
And Detroit is not the only city struggling to keep up its obligations when it comes to maintaining parks and vacant land.
It's happening all over.
Robin Boyle is a professor of urban planning at Wayne State University.
Many of these cities are facing similar problems, nothing quite to the scale of Detroit. The story of what's happening in places like Flint, for example, in Michigan, or Youngstown in Ohio. And these are just, if I can use that cliche, the poster children for this challenge.
Last summer, the mayor of Toledo, Ohio, asked residents to bring their lawnmowers to city parks and spent several Saturdays cutting park lawns himself. A recent audit of Milwaukee County's park system suggests selling some parkland to help deal with a maintenance backlog. And just 2 years ago, Detroit's former mayor pitched a failed plan to sell 92 city parks to help close a budget deficit. Detroit's attorneys are trying to hold on to Eliza Howell Park. They say even if a park is barricaded to vehicles or the grass isn't mowed, it's still a park. George Besnar agrees. He comes to the park with his dogs several times a week.
Just because the lawn isn't mowed all the time, that doesn't matter to me, because to me it represents more like a natural preserve where you see birds, you see deer, you see fox, you know, you see everything here.
Including things you'd rather not see in nature, like bags of garbage and rusted playground equipment. Neighbors like Besnar say they hope Detroit will someday have the money to properly maintain this park. A judge is expected to decide this spring whether the city gets to keep the parkland. For the Environment Report, I'm Sarah Hewlett.
You might think your favorite television show is a source of entertainment and diversion. For you, maybe. For advertisers, it's all about delivering your eyeballs to their commercials. But many of us are watching TV differently in this age of TiVos and Hulu. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports advertisers are having a hard time keeping up.
$70 billion. That's how much money is spent on TV advertising every year. And those billions get spent based on data from one company. Nielsen basically has a stranglehold on television ad dollars.
They not only measure who was watching what programs, but they measure the average viewing of the commercials in those programs.
Bill Gorman's blog is called TV by the Numbers. Pretty much all it does is look at Nielsen ratings.
The revenue potential of a show is all that matters.
Networks are businesses, Gorman says, and they want to sell commercials.
That's the only thing that matters. And what allows them to sell advertising at better prices is better ratings.
One show on FX has been getting terrific ratings. Sons of Anarchy is about a California motorcycle gang. Its viewership rose 66% from its first season to its second. Nielsen reported its finale was the most watched show in its time slot among men aged 18 to 49. The way Nielsen breaks down those numbers annoys Kurt Sutter. He's the show's creator.
I think the worst thing that ever happened to television viewing was research about television viewing, how people watch TV and why people watch TV and what are they doing the first 15 minutes and then what are they doing.
But does that kind of detailed Nielsen information justify $70 billion a year? Advertising executive Kate Serkin.
I'm not sure that that metric is the only metric that we need going forward.
Serkin suggests that Nielsen is falling behind right at the moment when the ways we watch television are multiplying. She works for a big firm called Starcom MediaVest. It's part of a new consortium of powerful ad agencies and TV networks. It's pressuring Nielsen to adapt to a new, flipped-around business model where people don't always watch TV on TV.
If a TV show goes out on iTunes, Hulu, regular television, how many people saw that, who those people were?
Big advertisers can no longer rely just on Nielsen as they did for decades. Now they go to a bunch of different companies for metrics. For example, TiVo tells Serkin's company which of their ads caught people's attention and which were skipped through.
We want to know what a consumer is doing, understanding when we're paying for advertising, how many people saw our commercials.
Soon, Nielsen promises it'll be able to deliver more measurements. Steve Hasker is Nielsen's president of media products. He says the company is laboring to get new measurements in place that'll combine data about how people watch TV online, on regular TV, and even on smartphones and other mobile devices.
We'll be able to tell what type of video they watch, what type of sites they go to, how they interact with those sites, what they buy on those sites, what types of news articles they're reading.
That measurement won't even be fully ready for almost 2 years. And it does not yet include shows streamed on websites owned by networks, like Hulu, the nation's second largest video site, with over 43 million users each month. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
There's an even more unusual way to watch TV. It involves ABC's hit drama Lost. The premiere of the show's final season airs tonight. Many fans hope this season will answer key questions and tie up loose ends. A few hardcore fans couldn't wait, so they headed out to Hawaii this past weekend, where the show is filmed, to watch an early screening of the premiere. Hawaii Public Radio's Ben Marcus was there.
Hawaii's lush tropical scenery is perfect for producing a show about a group of people stranded on a remote island. And local tour companies on Oahu have cashed in on the show's success. Driving this lost tour is Matt Marici, a guide for EDCOS Tours. Marici's brought these lost fans to Waimanalo Beach. Before them is pristine white sandy beach and electric blue ocean. Marici holds a binder with pictures from the show, including one of this precise view.
This is the Thailand beach, okay? You can see this ridge line is right over there. Now, when they pan more this way, they added in computer graphic islands, so because it's supposed to be Phuket.
The group clicks away with their digital cameras. Tour guide Marici points out the peculiar body art some fans display, whether it's pictures of prominent lost characters or lost mottos.
I feel at home when I get crazy fans around, like my man here with the Shannon tattoo. I've had somebody with a Dharma tattoo. I've had newlywed couples that put the phrase, live together, die alone, in their wedding vows. You know, Jack says, if we can't live together, we're going to die alone, right? I mean, I'm telling you.
The day of the premiere, a large group of those crazy fans are meeting at Lulu's restaurant in Waikiki for brunch. Across the street, a 30-foot screen has been erected on the beach for the showing. Ryan Ozawa, who lives here on Oahu, helped organize this get-together for his fellow losties.
There's many names for us. Losers has been used periodically, but yes, we're losties.
Ozawa and his wife host a podcast devoted to Lost called The Transmission. At one point, it boasted more than 30,000 subscribers.
You've got the mainstream audience that loves it. It's a primetime network TV show, but you've really got the serious nerd contingent, the Comic-Con contingent, the people who, you know, have scale models of the USS Enterprise in their house. So bringing those two worlds together is frightening but fantastic.
What's grabbed the attention of Lost fans across the spectrum are the mysterious and complicated storylines. Ozawa says Lost came about at a time when social media hit its stride. The internet is filled with fans posting back and forth their own theories about characters and fleshing out the rich mythology of the show.
And because Lost is a global show, it's a global online audience. I mean, right on the beach, we've got folks from Turkey, New Zealand, Australia, just coming from all over the world. They're trying to argue about who came the furthest for this event.
Those bragging rights probably go to Rina Kapuya from Istanbul.
I have a 12-hour time difference with Hawaii, so I'm thinking I'm literally from across the world, and I don't think anybody's come farther. I'm the craziest of them all.
Later that day, as the sun set, thousands of fans filled Waikiki Beach for the screening.
Destiny.
Sorry, for you Lost fans who love spoilers, I'm not telling. For blogger, podcaster, and Uber fan Ozawa, there are only a few surprises since he's been stalking out these film locations for months. But for his wife, this was all new.
She was sobbing like a baby, trying hard not to, but the more she held it back, the more her body would shake. So I just loved it. It was fantastic.
For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.
And finally, this half hour, a story about an Olympic sport that's not for the timid, Nordic combined. It features ski jumping and a grueling cross-country ski race. For the first time ever, the U.S. will arrive at the Winter Games with one of the best Nordic combined teams in the world. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann has this profile of an American who's going ski tip to ski tip with the world's best.
In March of last year, Bill DeMung climbed in full racing gear into the VIP stand and shook hands with King Harald of Norway. DeMung had just won the coveted King's Cup Nordic Combined, the first American to claim that prize since 1968. DeMung says his victory in Norway was another sign that he and the U.S. team have arrived.
Definitely when we compete, I think the other countries take notice, and it's more exciting and more fun for us because, you know, we do have that belief there. We're not trying to come out of the dregs and make something happen.
DeMung first emerged on the world scene at the Nagano Olympics 12 years ago when he was still in high school.
Looks strong from the takeoff, very high. DeMung puts one down there, and what a time to do it.
He didn't medal that year, but he slowly shouldered his way into the middle rank of Nordic combined skiers, testing himself against the dominant Europeans and Scandinavians.
He has traveled all over the globe, and he's still very much at heart a North Country boy.
DeMung's parents, Helen and Leo, raised him and his sister Kate in the backwoods of New York's Adirondack Mountains, where hard winter can last 7 months of the year.
I've always been an avid outdoors person, so it was just a natural thing to take the kids with me, you know.
I have photographs of Bill and Kate in the dead of winter putting on their bathing suit and diving off of our front porch into the deep snow. Just this fearless quality.
Lake Placid was a 20-minute drive from home, close enough that DeMung started training at age 7. Chris Seymour coached him as a kid and says it was clear early on that DeMung was different.
He's really physiologically a little bit of an anomaly. He's, as far as endurance athletics go, he was given a set of genetics that have made him superior to most.
DeMung's steady progress came to a crashing halt in 2002 after the Olympics in Salt Lake City.
A top North Country ski racer has been hospitalized in Germany following a head injury suffered in a hotel swimming pool.
DeMung fractured his skull and was lucky to be alive. His doctors doubted whether he would ever compete again.
That was when I kind of took the time to get away from the sport, to clear my head out a little bit, and then make the decision to come back.
The final kilometer now, and DeMung is making his move. Content for second for the moment, and not anymore. Bill DeMung.
DeMung now credits that year off with helping him find the joy again in competing. He relaxed, found his rhythm, and in 2009, he reached the podium 10 times in World Cup races, an astonishing record for any Nordic combined racer and unheard of for an American. Here he is last February, grabbing the gold medal at the World Championships broadcast on NBC.
The German can't match the intensity of a hyper-determined Bill DeMung.
Bill DeMung was born right after the Lake Placid Winter Games, and there's a photograph of his mom, Helen, standing pregnant in front of the blazing torch. 30 years later, the goal is to take all the pieces, the family, the winter days in the Adirondacks, the years of competition, and put them together in Vancouver.
When you know that you're good enough, when you have that faith, it's about arriving at the Olympics on autopilot and ready to just do what you do best and enjoy that.
For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann in Saranac Lake, New York.
Earth and Sky.
Tuesday, February 2nd, 2010. The best time of year to see the planet Saturn is approaching.
Saturn is the faintest of the bright planets, so it's not the easiest planet to spot. But there's always a time each year when the distance between Earth and Saturn is least. That starts each year when our two worlds are on the same side of the Sun, with Earth about to pass between the Sun and Saturn. And that's what's happening now.
Earth will pass between the Sun and Saturn next month. So this planet is now nearly at its best in our sky for this year. To see the planet Saturn, you have to stay up until mid to late evening or wake up in the wee hours before sunrise. Fortunately, the waning gibbous moon shines fairly close to Saturn tonight, so you can use the moon to locate this planet.
Golden Saturn, the most distant world that you can easily see with the unaided eye, shines about as brightly as a bright star. But it's not as bright as the brightest star, Sirius, or the planets Jupiter and Venus. Just remember, tonight, the moon and Saturn will rise in mid-evening.
They'll soar to their